In this hour of Focus 580, we will be talking with Stella Remington. For 30 years, she worked for Britain's security service, MI5, beginning in 1965. Over that time, she worked in all of the main fields of the service's responsibilities, including counter-subversion, counter-espionage, and counter-terrorism. She became the director of all three of those branches, and then in 1992, she was appointed Director General of all of MI5, and she was the first woman ever to hold the job. She also was the first Director General whose name was publicly announced when she was appointed. She retired in 1996. At that time, she published an autobiography about her experiences, titled Open Secret, that was published in the UK in 2001. And just last year, she published her first novel, and not surprisingly, it is a spy thriller. It's titled At Risk. It's published by Knopf. She's also now working on a second novel. The first was well-received. It has done well in Britain and certainly is expected to do well here in the United States. And right at the moment, she is spending some time traveling around the United States talking about it. And today is in Chicago. And I do want to mention for anyone who might happen to be listening in the Chicago area that she will be making an appearance doing a book signing tonight at 7 o'clock at Barbara's Bookstore. That's in Oak Park, at 1100 Lake Street. And I'm sure that anybody who would be interested in turning out and meeting her should feel welcome. Here this morning on the program, of course, if people would like to call in, you would certainly be welcome to do that too. In Champaign-Urbana, where we are, 333-9455. That is the number. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one is good anywhere that you can hear us, around Illinois, Indiana. If it would be long distance call for you, certainly feel free to use that number, and that is 800-222-9455. So here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free 800-222-9455. Ms. Remington, hello.
Hello.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
Not at all. I'm pleased to.
We certainly appreciate it. Let me begin by asking you a question, and I'm sure that you have no doubt tired of answering this question, but it is frequently asked, I'm sure, and one of the first things that people ask, and that is, what precisely is MI5?
Well, MI5 is the Domestic Security Service of Britain, and that means that it's responsible for trying to protect the country against serious threats to our national security, whatever they may be, and obviously they vary depending on the state of the world at any given moment. When I joined in the 60s, the overwhelming threat came from espionage from the Soviet Union and its allies. And then as the years went on, terrorism started to rear its head. And now, obviously, the overwhelming threat to my country, as well as to yours, comes from terrorism. And the way they do that is by trying to generate intelligence about what's being planned so that they can use that intelligence to stop the harm that's intended.
And it's my understanding, too, that that MI5 is a purely, let us say, investigative kind of body, that it doesn't have any police power, so that you, for example, if you suspected someone who was involved in espionage, MI5 could not arrest them. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. It's not a police service, so it's different from the FBI, for example. So what it does, as I say, is raise the intelligence, work on it, assess it, try to get more, and try to get as clear a picture as possible about what's being intended, and then talk with the police about the best way to prevent it, whether it's by arresting people, which the police would do, or by some other means.
As I mentioned, you were the first Director General of MI5 whose name was made public when you were appointed, and I'm assuming that in the past, before you had that job, the identity of the individual was kept secret for their protection. Why was the decision made at that point, when you were appointed to head MI5, to announce publicly who you were?
Well, you're right. Previous to my appointment, the names of the heads of the services had always been kept secret. It was partly for their protection, but also partly because the British Security and Intelligence Services were just very secretive organizations in those days. And, you know, that goes back to the Cold War, when the main threat was of the infiltration of each side's intelligence services by the other. But the reason why my name was appointed, it was a decision taken by the government, and it was based on the fact that a law had been passed in 1989 to govern the work of MI5. Until then, it was not based on a sort of legal basis. It was based on various other things. But the government decided that now it was sort of legally based, then the public had a right to know who was leading the organization. So the decision was taken, and I was the first to be covered by it, that from then on, the public should know the names of the leaders of Britain's three different intelligence services. It came as a great shock, of course, to the public and particularly to the media, because not only was I the first person whose name was announced in that job, but I was the first woman to hold the job. And so the media suddenly had this startling announcement about, you know, the name of the person. And also, I turned out not to be James Bond, but to be a middle-aged lady with two children. And that wasn't at all what was expected.
I understand that when that happened, it got a lot of attention from the media. And that, in fact, is this true that some of your neighbors asked you to move?
Yes, it did get a lot of attention from the media because they were absolutely tantalized by the announcement, and particularly by the fact that we didn't issue a photograph because it was at a time when the IRA was very active in Britain. So for security reasons, no photograph was issued. So as you can imagine, the media, with an announcement that they regarded as startling and no photograph to go with it, immediately started to try and find out where we lived, which wasn't difficult because we'd always lived just in an ordinary London street, relying on my anonymity. And then they all turned up at the front door. And, of course, the neighbours began to think, hey, having this woman living in our street is a threat to our own safety. So various people said to me things like, I wish you wouldn't go to work just as I'm taking my children to school, and various other rather unfriendly things. And in the end, when one newspaper decided to publish a photograph of our house on the front page, we had to sell that house and move, first of all, into a succession of most unsuitable apartments at the top of all our office buildings. It's sort of six floors up, and I had a dog, and, you know, we had to go down in the lift and walk past the security guard in order to take the dog for a walk. And then we ended up living in a proper place, but having to live undercover, under covert name, in order that, you know, our location should remain secret.
And now, though, it is still the identities of the person who has your job now, who also heads MI6, those people still are known publicly?
Yes, their names are publicly known. But, of course, the announcement of their names didn't cause anything like the furore, because by then, you know, I'd been through all that, and people were expecting the announcement of those appointments. And so they had a much quieter time of it than I did, being the first.
I understand that when you, with this book, this fictional book that you've written, and also with your autobiography, before they were published, they had to be cleared by the government?
Yes, that's right. The rules are that whatever I write, or anybody else who's been in my former profession wants to write for publication, has got to be cleared. With my novel, there wasn't any problem with that because clearly, you know, it's a novel and nothing in it is entirely based on fact. With my autobiography, it was more difficult. They had more anxiety about it, even though it was never my intention to write anything that would reveal any of the nation's secrets. I was asked to take a few things out. I was asked to change the way I express certain things. But, in fact, not a great deal is different from what I originally wrote.
One thing that strikes me, given the kind of reputation that the media has these days, I understand that during the process, during the time that the government, the British government, was looking at your autobiography, Open Secret, to try to make sure that there was nothing problematic in there, someone leaked a copy of the book to The Sun, which is a tabloid, and in fact, what the paper did was they returned it to the government and they didn't reveal anything of what was in it.
Well, that's quite true. It was a very curious episode because I'd submitted the first draft, a very early draft of my autobiography, for clearance. And somebody within the clearance system had decided that they didn't think I ought to publish this and, you know, set about trying to prevent me in their own way. So they put a copy of this first draft in a brown envelope and sent it in a cab round to the Sun newspaper, who obviously had to scratch their head about what they were going to be able to do about this amazing scoop that they'd acquired, and decided that they would, in fact, not publish it. I suppose they thought that they'd probably fall over the copyright laws apart from anything else. So they put it in another cab and sent it around to number 10 Downing Street, accompanied, of course, by lots of photographers, and made a story out of it that way. The disadvantage for me, of course, was that the fact that I was planning to write my autobiography came out a lot earlier than I would have wanted it to do, because we were only at first draft stage.
Our guest again in this part of Focus 580, Stella Remington. She is a former Director General of MI5, Britain's Domestic Security Service. And as we've mentioned here a couple of times, when she was appointed, she became the first woman to hold the post. It was also the first director whose name was publicly announced when she was appointed. She authored, after retiring, an autobiography. That book is titled Open Secret. And now she has a novel, a thriller, a spy thriller, which is titled At Risk. It's published by Knopf, is expected to do well here in the United States as it did in Britain, and she is spending some time here in the United States talking about it, touring, and she is in Chicago. We'll be doing a book signing tonight in Oak Park at Barbara's Bookstore. So again, if people who are listening up that way should feel welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana on our show, if you'd like to call in, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. Good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. And we do have a caller here, have a couple. First is listening in Indiana this morning on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Hello. A couple general questions. Number one, I presume that the newspapers were told that if you publish this woman's portrait, and even if you go so far as show actually where she lives, that you're going to cause a lot of harm for her. I wonder if that was actually brought up and what reason they used to go ahead with that. That seems rather heavy-handed to me. I'm trying to think about any... you know, our tabloids over here might try it. I don't know. I don't read them, but I don't think any regular newspaper would have done that. They would have tried to solve their wouldn't have a story another way. Second question deals with sort of really a broad question in our country now is sort of the turf wars between the CIA, the FBI, the Department of Defense, and other outfits that, in the broad sense, are spies. Did you or do you have, or what did you ever have, that sort of problem when you were in the service there, that the group that was concerned about external affairs didn't tell you who were concerned about domestic affairs, in the sense that the glove never got on the hand the way it should have? And a third broad one is, can you give some reason why the people who write spy stories, the better ones, I guess I'd have to say, are from Great Britain in the broad sense. Thanks a lot.
All right. Well, thanks for the questions. You may take them in whatever order you like.
Okay. Well, I'll start with the first one, which is where the newspapers told that to publish details of me and photographs and things would cause harm. I think the answer is that they probably weren't specifically told. I think they should have known, but I don't think they were specifically told. There is a rule, actually, in the UK, certainly now, that the names of people who work in the intelligence services are not allowed to be revealed. But, of course, we were, in a sense, revealing my name, and I think the papers thought maybe, you know, it was open house. I think nowadays they would realize that to publish photographs in an unauthorized way, and certainly to publish a photograph of somebody's house, would be a crazy thing to do. But, you know, I think both we, possibly, and also the media, were a bit naive in those days, and we've all grown up a lot since then. As far as turf wars go, which was your second question, are they as bad in the UK as they appear to be here? I think the answer to that is no. I think the reason why is that we have been dealing with these sort of particularly terrorist incidents for much longer in the UK and in Europe in general than you have here. Don't forget that we had the IRA over many years, as well as various sort of international terrorist incidents taking place on our streets. And during those years, I think Britain's intelligence services have learned the importance of working together. And we have learned the importance of making sure that each of them knows what their area of responsibility is. And so I don't think we do suffer from turf wars. Now and again, obviously, individuals will not work too well together, and our... particularly MI6 and MI5 are very different organizations. They employ very different kinds of people, so they will rub up against each other. But I don't think we've got that very serious situation that appears now to be being identified in this country. And finally, why do spy writers, good spy writers, come from the United Kingdom? I can't answer that. I don't know. I mean, there's one obviously very famous spy writer in the form of John le Carré, who has written a lot about British intelligence, particularly during the Cold War, who is very good. There are a number of others, but I think there are some quite good spy writers from all over the world, actually. Maybe Britain's intelligence services, because they've been around a long time and people know about them, are more exciting as a subject.
Hmm. Well, and I know from having read about you that for your recreational reading, you like to read spy thrillers. Maybe not surprising given the line of work that you were in. Was it that and your own experience that led you, when it came time to retire, to think that you'd like to try your hand writing in that genre yourself?
Yeah, I think it was, actually. I've always been a thriller reader, not only spy stories, but, you know, police stories as well. In fact, I can remember that before I joined MI5, when I was tapped on the shoulder, as it turned out, I was a diplomat's wife in India when I got the call. I had just been reading Kipling's Kim, which was a story about what he called the Great Game, spies disguised as Afghan tribesmen on the northwest frontier of India. And when I joined, I thought it was all going to be like that, very exciting stuff out of the stories. But it wasn't, of course. And I've gone on reading thrillers all the way through my career. And the kind I particularly like are thrillers set in what look like very familiar surroundings, but strange things happen. And that's why I set my book in London, but also in a rural part of England called Norfolk, where there are huge, wide, empty beaches and quiet lanes, and you'd think nothing ever happened. But in my story, things do start to happen. Those are the kind of books I like.
Well, you know what Sherlock Holmes said about crime in the countryside.
What did he say?
He said something about the fact he and Watson were having a conversation one day and about bad things that happen in London, and Holmes said something about things are even worse in the country,
yeah.
And Watson was sort of surprised, and he said, well, it was because of the isolation.
Yes.
So it's because the people can do things out there without being seen that you'd be surprised about.
Well, I think that's very true, actually. That's why people who are trying to do nasty things choose quiet places, because they think they won't be seen.
The hero of your book is a woman, a single woman, who comes up through MI5 and no doubt has perhaps some of the same experiences that you had, at least has to live with the same dynamic of being a woman in a male-dominated organization. She doesn't have children as you do and did, but how much of her experiences have been lifted from your own life?
Yes, some certainly have. And I mean, it is true that when I joined MI5, when I actually joined it as a full-time employee, which by then was the very end of the 1960s, it was a very male-dominated world, and in particular, women were not thought suitable to do the sharp-end intelligence work. That gradually changed as the years went by. But I remember going on the very first training course. I was the first woman to be allowed to go on a training course where we were being taught how to recruit and run human sources of information. And it was clearly a course designed entirely for men, because the very first little exercise on it was that you had to go into a pub and you had to identify anybody in the pub, chat them up, and find out as much as you possibly could about them. Now, that was clearly very unsuitable for a woman, because when I was given my pub and I went in there and it was absolutely full of men, and I had to identify one of these unlikely-looking characters and start chatting him up, and it was quite clear to me that he was beginning to think that my purpose was something quite different from intelligence gathering when, you know, the man from the course swept in and the whole thing was broken up. So that's how it was when I first joined. And as far as Liz goes, the heroine of my book, it's a bit the same. She's obviously working in a service that now is not male-dominated, and it really is not anymore. But she still feels that she's got to sort of prove herself and gets cross if she's patronized by her male colleagues, one of whom does patronize her in the book, who is Bruno from MI6. She also has the same difficulty, I think, in balancing her private life with working in a secret organization, which I had always and which I think people still do have. and she's got the same difficulty of doing a job that requires, you know, 100% 7 days a week commitment sometimes while trying to keep her life in order. But I think, like me, she's dedicated to it, really, and I think like most people who work in that area are, and, you know, she's excited by it at the same time as depressed by it sometimes, and she wouldn't really do anything else, as I wouldn't. Though she toys with giving it up and working with her mother in the nursery garden in the country, and I toyed with giving it up sometimes, and I did, in fact, apply for a job as headmistress of a girls' boarding school, but I never pursued that. So, yeah, she's autobiographical up to a point. Yeah.
I was looking at an article here that I found on the BBC website that had some quotes from a television interview that you gave, apparently your first. This was in 2001, so it must have been around the time that the autobiography came out. And I was struck by one of the quotes here where you were talking about some of the difficulties of pursuing the career that you did as a woman. And you said, "I was never a chap, and I'm not going to behave the same way as chaps behave. I never have, and I never will." I wonder if can you give an example from your career where you were in a professional situation and you did something that you could say, "I know that no man would have done it this way."
Well, I suppose when you work in an intelligence service, now and again you have to work undercover, clearly, and the covers you choose as a woman are obviously, you know, very different from the cover that a man would choose. And I can't give you precise examples of the covers that I chose because I think that would get too near to talking about operations, which I'm not entitled to do. But I think, you know, you have to remember that when women joined the ranks of the frontline intelligence officers, they brought with them a whole new way of doing things and a whole additional suite of possibilities which men working by themselves did not have. So my view is that the arrival of women at the front line of intelligence work has certainly greatly increased the possibilities for the way the work is done.
We are at our midpoint, or almost at our midpoint, and we have several callers, and we'll get right to them. And perhaps I should just introduce again our guest, Stella Remington. She was Director General of MI5, Britain's Domestic Security Service, and in fact was the first woman to hold that post. She retired a number of years ago at that time, shortly after, not very long after, published an autobiography about her experiences, and now has a new book out. It's a novel. It's a spy thriller. It was published in Britain, I believe, last year, and is just now coming out here in the United States. It's titled At Risk, and it's published by Knopf. So if you'd like to read it, you can head out to the bookstore and look for it. And also, as I have mentioned, she is now touring, spending some time in the United States. She's in Chicago, and if you're in that area, you would like to meet her. She's doing a book signing at Barbara's Bookstore in Oak Park on Lake Street tonight, 7 o'clock, so you can go down there. And here on the program, if you'd like to call in, talk with her, you could do that, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Next caller here in line is Champaign County, line 1. Hello.
Hi. Good morning. We're out here in the countryside, but I noticed that you're going to be inside the Beltway on a radio show sometime in the next week, and so maybe we can regard this as rehearsal for a more capital sort of question. But inside of Britain, there've been these series of investigations into intelligence, the Hutton, the Butler, and most everything that I read about them, the critics say that the remit wasn't wide enough, so there's still a row about it, and I don't know if how comfortable you feel about commenting on any of that, but I have since it does leave so many openings for what people call conspiracy theory or novelistic invention, since it is a mystery, the specific thing of David Kelly's suicide, supposed, accepting that it might have been a suicide, though this testimony from these medical technicians that there wasn't enough blood on the site for it had really been necessarily a suicide, but accepting that it would have been, I have this scenario that it's kind of a novel, I guess. The idea is that he had a personal foible that somebody was blackmailing him with. Since he was just about to go off to Iraq, I thought, well, perhaps somebody was trying to get him to, pony up some WMDs in in Iraq, like participate in some kind of production of the same, since the Iraqis apparently weren't producing any anymore. And that he was in this dilemma of having to participate in this, conspiracy, or have his life ruined by revealing something in his personal... Now, whether that was done by Defense Intelligence, the CIA, or any other acronyms, I don't know. It just seems like a very interesting story that a novelist who also has been intelligence director might have an interesting reflection on.
Yes. Well, thank you for your question. My experience is that most conspiracy theories are wrong, I'm afraid. Sorry to sort of pour cold water on that.
Well, I don't think you can start with that. I mean, maybe that's true, but that doesn't mean they all are.
No, it doesn't mean they all are. Most are, though. So I would, you know, I would look always at theories of conspiracy theories first from that point of view, and then saying a bit more about the investigations, and particularly the David Kelly story, the situation there. I think it all ties together, really, because it seems to me that as a result of the investigations, clearly, what went wrong primarily in the UK was the assessment of such intelligence as there was. And there wasn't a great deal of good intelligence coming out of Iraq, obviously, before the war, and not on neither side of the Atlantic. And that doesn't surprise me greatly, because there are some intelligence targets that are extremely difficult, and the intelligence services are not miracle workers. But what seems to have gone wrong on my side of the Atlantic is that some of the intelligence that there was, which turned out not to be right, had not been properly assessed and had got to the government and the Prime Minister without being looked at by other people who should have had an angle on it, and without having the necessary sort of scepticism and caveats applied to it. And that, you know, looking at the results of the various inquiries that we have had, seems to have been ultimately the cause for the David Kelly suicide. In other words, he did not feel that he had been properly consulted, and he was an expert on weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. He felt, I think, that, you know, various assessments had been come to that hadn't allowed experts in his area really to comment on. So I think that there is, you know, there is a straightforward explanation for the very sad situation that ultimately occurred. And certainly from my point of view, I wouldn't think that you need to look much further than that, and that the conspiracy theory is probably unlikely to be true. But that's only my interpretation.
Well, just on the face of it, that he would be that anguished about not being consulted sounds a little implausible to me.
Well, maybe, but you have to remember that he was then, what lay behind all this was a huge argument between the British government and the BBC, who came forth at one stage and announced that the British government had knowingly misled the people. And that comment was sourced to a conversation which a BBC journalist had with Dr. David Kelly. So he was then hauled before a parliamentary committee on the television, and, you know, his whole life then became public, and he was clearly anguished by all that and felt that he'd got caught up, as far as I can tell, into some major debate between, an argument even, between the government and the BBC. So I think that, in my opinion anyway, adequately explains what happened.
Yeah, I watched the testimony that he gave. And he was certainly drubbed well, but it still seems to me that there must have been some other factors, and there always are in a suicide, of course. So, I still think, since as I've heard, the remit was never wide enough about the sexed up, dodgy documents, et cetera, et cetera, that there's still a lot of wide room for speculation.
Certainly there is a lot of speculation still, and I've no doubt, you know, there will go on being for many years.
All right. Well, I appreciate the call. As we have mentioned, there are certain, because of the position that you held, there are certain things that you cannot talk about. You're still covered by the Official Secrets Act. Do you feel constrained talking about current politics? Or as I'm sure that people seek out your opinions, and I know you've been quoted about talking about the war on terror and so forth, you feel that you can say and do speak your mind if asked?
I feel that I can speak my mind, yes. What I can't talk about is operational issues or, you know, sort of methods and techniques. But then as I am now 8 years away from being actively involved myself, I don't actually have that much information left in my head, which is actually a great relief to me. Mm-hmm. But yes, I feel that I can say what I feel. But of course, you know, having been for quite a long time within the government, I probably understand more about what goes on than many people who are looking at it from the outside, which is why some of my comments may appear, you know, to be sort of quite cautious and balanced, maybe.
Let's talk with some others. Now in Urbana, next line, number two. Hello.
Good morning.
Morning.
Can I turn to another form of fiction, espionage fiction? With the advent of the BBC America cable service, I've been able to watch, I don't want to call it old, because it's the 70s and early 80s, which for many people isn't that long ago, but what I consider an early program set in Britain about one of the espionage services and focused on an official of that service who is responsible for those operatives that go abroad and actually recruit intelligence sources.
Mm-hmm.
And the fun of the program, other than the details that they show, was the exotic locales in which every week he would have to go somewhere, deal with someone, and usually they were rather pleasant Mediterranean sites, islands throughout the Mediterranean that most American programs seem not to go for. Well, that aside, does this ring a bell? You're familiar with the program, because I wish I could remember the title, and at the moment it escapes me.
I don't think I am. I mean, it sounds a bit like James Bond, but I assume that's not what it is.
It was a television series, and I remember that the acting was first rate. I bring this up for one reason only. At the end of the series, when it was obvious they were not going to continue, the writers had an opportunity to sum up, and they had the star injured, having to resign, and before he left office, being asked to summarize his experiences so as to help guide the next few years of the service and his successor. And in addition to the practical, tactical details of what should be done different in this and that instance, he finished up by saying that the focus should be more long-term rather than short-term, and that the strategy, and this I'm just kind of hoping for your reaction in light of the coincidence, his argument for long-term strategy is that the service for which he works would win, in quotation marks, if they focused, and I think it was Eurocentric more than worldwide, on not inculcating, but helping the process of democratic change in the countries in which they were operating, that the more they had allies, the better they would be, and the way to get allies was to foster democracy as a ideal in the countries, to put aside some of the realpolitik details of what they were doing day by day and year in, year out, and do what could be done to set the stage for, set the seeds for. I mean, it sounds just like the speech we just heard.
Mm.
And I know this was written somewhere in the late 70s, early 80s. How, in the philosophy of espionage, in your experience, how was that ever brought up?
Well, I
was
think
it only
that,
in this television program where the writers obviously were making their pitch for the idea.
Yes. I think what you're describing is something that I feel quite strongly, which is that terrorism, for example, is really only going to be conquered if we tackle the causes of terrorism. And what you have to have is at least a two-pronged approach. And the responsibility of services like my former service is to deal with the immediate. In other words, their job is to try and find out what's going on now and try and protect us by preventing incidents that are being planned immediately. In my opinion, it's the responsibility of politicians to try and deal with the causes of terrorism over the long term and try and make sure that the things that cause people to turn to terrorism as a way of bringing their cause to the attention of the world are addressed. And that's why I feel to talk about the war on terrorism is perhaps an oversimplification, because it implies really that, you know, by intelligence or by military activity, you can actually bring terrorism to an end. In my opinion, you can't, because terrorism has proved such a wonderful way for the terrorists, and this is the way they would look at it, of bringing their cause to our attention, that I think people will go on turning to terrorism, you know, for different reasons over the years. And we're never actually, unfortunately and sadly, going to be able to wipe it out totally. But each time terrorism comes up, I think we have to address, as well as the detail, we have to address the causes of terrorism, and that I hope the politicians are doing.
I appreciate, again, the comments of the caller. We're moving into our last 15 minutes, and I have some other callers. I hope he will forgive me for wanting to go on to someone else. But just quickly to ask this question, I think that as people have, particularly people in the intelligence business, have reflected on the progress or lack of progress that we have made in dealing with terrorism, they say one of our weaknesses is that we have not been very successful in infiltrating terrorist organizations. They tend to be very closed. Mm. It's difficult to get our operatives placed in them to persuade someone who is already in that organization to be a double agent. To, you know, the human intelligence it's been very difficult, and that says something about the nature of terrorist organizations as opposed to something like the KGB, for example. Not to say that that would have been easy, but it's different. Do you think that that's something that is likely to change, or will that always be a problem in trying to gather intelligence on organizations like Al-Qaeda or whatever will come next, and certainly there will be others?
Mm. I think it is undoubtedly a very difficult thing to do. I mean, when we were dealing with the KGB, we knew what kind of an organization it was. We knew where the headquarters were. We knew a lot about their people. We knew what they were trying to do. With dealing with Al-Qaeda and its offshoots, it seems to me much more difficult, because we don't really. They don't have a headquarters, or at least, you know, they don't in a place that we can investigate it. We don't know much about their operatives. We don't even know clearly, I think, what they actually want to do. So it is a much more difficult target, but there's no doubt whatsoever that human sources of information are absolutely vital to get the best intelligence, and it can be done. I mean, you can't actually infiltrate them by terrorist organizations normally by putting in what we used to call clean skins. In other words, people who have had absolutely no involvement with terrorism from the outside. But surprisingly enough, what can be done is that people who are in terrorist groups can be turned round, and some of them volunteer their services. And that's my experience from dealing with our own domestic terrorism over the years. So it can be done. But it is a difficult thing, and that's why I say that people should just hesitate a bit before criticizing the intelligence services for not being able to produce, you know, 100% intelligence about what is being planned.
Well, let me quickly again introduce our guest for anyone who has just tuned in. Stella Remington joined Britain's security service, MI5, in 1965 and had a career there of 30 years working in all of the fields of the service's responsibilities. She became the Director General of MI5 in 1992, was the first woman to hold the post. She retired in 1996, published an autobiography, Open Secret, in the UK. That's in 2001. And then last year published her first novel. It's a spy thriller. It's titled At Risk, published by Knopf. And also there is another one, or will be another one. I know I wrote down the title here someplace, Secret Asset.
Secret Asset. Right. I'm working on that now, yes.
All right. And she's now touring in the United States, talking about her work and her life and her writing, and is in Chicago. We have some other callers here. We'll try to get them all in the time that we have left. Next, Urbana Line 3. Hello.
Hey, was Remington Steel named after you?
No, I don't think so. I think Remington Steel is Rem, and I'm Rim. So
okay.
There is a difference, but I think that Remington Steel came first before my name was publicly announced.
Okay. You know, on that question of why the best spy novel writers are British,
mm-hmm.
You know, the U.S. culture has always been this kind of a gung-ho military culture, really, really kind of force and strength-oriented, whereas the British culture has always valued, you know, subtlety and nuance and cleverness and stuff like that. And, you know, there was always a big deal over that James Bond's pistol that he carried around was always smaller than the one he was supposed to have,
right.
The standard issue, whereas Dirty Harry, on the other hand, his revolver was always bigger than it was supposed to be.
Well, that says something about the culture of the two different countries, I think.
Yeah, so I think the British side is kind of more... you know, oriented toward the espionage is kind of more...
Yeah.
More.
Well, it may be because MI5 is not a police service, and so what it has to do, you know, is the careful, subtle raising of intelligence and then the assessment of it, which is, you know, different from a military approach, different from a police approach.
Yeah. Okay, I have two questions. First of all, if it's occurred to me that if a woman were put in charge of an intelligence service, and her identity was kept secret, and then that secret, identity was, divulged, was leaked. That maybe, you know, if the name of a male head of the service was made known, well, okay, fine, that was a leak. But if it was a woman's name, that could actually have political implications. And I wondered if that might have. Had something to do with your name being made public.
I think the answer to that is probably yes. I think as well as a good openness story for the government, it was also a good equality story for the government. A woman, you know, in a previously man's job. But of course, it's no doubt that because I was a woman, the announcement attracted a great deal more attention and more media interest than it probably would have done if I'd been a man, which is what would have been expected.
I guess my point was if they had not divulged it, it could have had negative consequences if it were leaked.
Yes. Well, I suppose that's possible as well. I'm not sure, really, whether people would see that having a woman in charge of an intelligence service was a negative. There's another woman actually in charge of MI5 now. So, you know, women play a big part in intelligence work in Britain anyway.
All right. Do you have any recommendations for what would you consider like... your favorite, like, classic spy novels or authors or whoever, what novels or authors you would recommend?
Well, have you read the John le Carré books, for example?
John Carré?
John le Carré.
Oh, le Carré.
And his hero is called Smiley, and he, I think, is wonderful at getting the atmosphere of the Cold War. What I remember when I first joined MI5, that sort of sense of, you know, the wilderness of mirrors, that nothing is exactly... how it appears to be, and perhaps the person that you're talking to and think is your colleague is in fact working for the other side. He's very good at that. So if you haven't read John le Carré, I would certainly recommend him. There are some earlier ones whom I like. I mean, if I go back as far as Kipling, you might find that you enjoy reading Kim, which is the book, as I say, that I was reading just before I joined MI5, which is all about the battle between Russia and the West in India, carried out through the eyes of the spies on the Northwest frontier. So that's another good one. More recently, the books I really like are police stories. I mean, there's a wonderful writer from Sweden called Henning Mankell, who has a policeman hero and is very good at creating sort of atmosphere of Sweden in the cold. So there are some suggestions for you anyway.
Alrighty, I'll hang up now. But I'll leave you with two comments. First of all, the war imagery and language coming out of the U.S. Administration, of course, is intentional in the war on terror. And my other last question would be if you were interested in talking about anything on the covert side of the war on terror, just what your comments would be on that. And thanks a lot.
Okay, thanks.
All right. Anything on that?
On the covert side of the war on terror, it's very important, is what I would say, and it's going on all the time. We don't see it And it's right that we shouldn't see it, but it is absolutely essential in order to particularly to raise information about what is being planned, you know, against us and our citizens on the streets of our countries.
All right, let's go to another caller. This would be Urbana Line 1. Hello.
Yeah, about small guns, I understand MI5 requires you to be 5'11 or smaller to get recruited, and there's a similar thing for females, so they also go on for... I guess all of the James Bond people would not have been able to be actual MI5 agents or whatever.
What, because they were too tall?
Yeah. But and I've read that your guest has said our treatment of prisoners in Guantanamo has been wrong-headed, and I think that's kind of admirable. But I have a question, which may be, which probably will reveal my lack of knowledge about the whole situation over in the UK. But I looked on the MI5 website, and they say that they are not a department of government. And, quote, we do not formulate or implement government policy, although we do advise government, unquote. And but during your tenure, I understand, you were particularly known for your capturing of IRA terrorists. But, you know, from over here in the Midwest, I always had the impression that the unionists were easily as active. And it seems to me that, therefore, by your being selective and only going after the IRA, weren't you implementing government policy, or do I have the whole thing wrong?
Well, to reply to that, I mean, it is true that MI5 is not a department of government. Its job is to raise intelligence about threats to the country and inform government what those are so that it can formulate the appropriate policies to deal with them. So that's the first point. Dealing with the IRA and the loyalists, as I would call them, MI5 worked against both of those two insofar as they were committing terrorism. And that was the responsibility of the intelligence services, not dealing with their sort of political aspects at all. And the IRA chose to carry out more prolonged and more violent terrorist activities in Great Britain than the loyalists did, so it's not surprising that our focus was more on them. But certainly, you know, we were not partisan, and where there was terrorism, that was what we went after.
Mm. One quick parting shot. I also read that some lady who was a agent at MI6 called Daphne Park kind of took issue with your attitude about sexism that you found, and I was just curious if you had anything to say about that. Apparently she says she even calls you a silly woman and all that, and I was just wondering if what was going on there, and I'll hang up and listen.
Okay. Well, I hadn't heard she'd said that, but she worked for MI6, not my former service, so I think the situation there was perhaps rather different.
All right, we'll leave it at that. We'll go on to another caller. This is someone listening in Champaign. Line 2, hello.
Hi, can you say anything about the history of the organization that you worked for before it got formalized?
Before what?
Well, he said before it was formalized. I guess I'm not really sure what exactly that means. Maybe you might talk a little bit about the history of
about their early history.
Yeah, about
MI5. Both MI5 and MI6 were founded in 1909 in order to tackle the threat from German espionage before the First World War. Before that, we had no sort of formalized intelligence services in Britain at all. And they were formed as... The reason why they're called MI is that they were formed as part of military intelligence in those days. But it was soon realized that there were two different jobs to do. One was to try and find out what was going on at home before the First World War, and one was to try and find out what was going on in Germany. So they split these two services, and one became MI6, which was the one looking out of the country, and one became MI5, which was the one that was sort of working against the threats at home. And as the years went on and as the wars ended and the threats to the country became different, the tasks of those services changed, but they remained separate with their focus, one abroad and one at home.
One of the things that I read about you was after your retirement from MI5, for a while you were working for Marks & Spencer, which is a British department store, I believe, and which seems to me a little unlikely. I think of, you know, a former director of the FBI, for example, going to work for JCPenney. It just seems sort of odd. Where did you find parallels between what you did, the world of counter-espionage, and the world of business?
No, not really. I worked as an outside director on the board of Marks & Spencer, so I wasn't there in order to bring any expertise specifically from the intelligence world. But what I was there for, I suppose, was as an outsider to bring my general expertise about what goes on at, you know, the center of government, etc. And also because I'd been through a huge period of change at the service when I was head of MI5 and during my time there. And most retail companies and companies of all kinds are going through huge change as well. So I think it was my experience of, you know, dealing with organizations in change that was valuable there.
Mm-hmm. The novel here is now out in the United States, At Risk, and there will be another secret asset that you're working on that involves the same character, the woman that is at the center of At Risk. Are you looking at this as a possible series? Would you like to continue to write at least a few more of these as long as there are people who are eager to read them?
Yes, I would, actually. And as I wind down my other jobs, really, you know, like I've now left the board of Marks & Spencer, so I will have a bit more time. I'm hoping to devote more time to writing a few more novels, and Liz Carlisle, the heroine, I hope, will feature in a few more.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Dame Stella, for talking with us this morning. We certainly do appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Our guest, Stella Remington. She is the former Director General of MI5, Britain Security Service. She was appointed the Director General in 1992, and as I have mentioned a number of times, she was the first woman to hold that job. She wrote an autobiography after retiring, Open Secret, published in 2001 in the UK, and has now a spy thriller out. It's titled At Risk. It's published by Knopf. And if you're in the Chicago area, you can look for her at Barbara's Bookstore tonight, 7 o'clock. That's in Oak Park. She's be doing a book signing there. Otherwise, you can head out to the bookstore and find the book if you'd like to read it.